This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Ten years after revolution toppled a dictator in Tunisia.
Freedom of expression, for example, is totally unprecedented.
In some ways, though, Tunisians are still struggling. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, a young Latina moves to a new U.S. city and tells her mom, let's just speak English in public.
Sometimes I don't really like speaking Spanish like out here because I know people stare.
We also hear from Ethiopian refugees who fled into Sudan. And this question, do travel restrictions halt the spread of disease? A former skeptic changes his tune.
Now that vaccines are so close, I don't want to risk traveling. I want to stay home. I want to shelter. I want to model the best behavior.
And the Lockerbie bombing, a potential breakthrough in a 32-year-old terrorism investigation. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is good to have you with us today. Since new variants of the coronavirus were discovered in the UK and South Africa, there has been a wave of travel bans and restrictions that have been imposed around the globe. It raises a question that was discussed a lot at the start of the pandemic. Just how effective are these restrictions? Our next guest, Lawrence Gostin, knows a lot about this. In the early 2000s, he was involved in revising the international health regulations for the World Health Organization to strongly discourage countries from implementing travel bans to slow the spread of disease. But Gostin says now it might be time to revisit that. Lawrence Gostin joins us from Washington. Professor, let's go back in time to the early 2000s when the WHO issued the regulations we just mentioned. What were the concerns, that the harms of restrictions would outweigh the good?
If you go back to that time, we were actually in another widespread epidemic, and it was the first coronavirus epidemic. It was the SARS epidemic. Canada in particular was really just brutally hit hard by travel restrictions throughout the world, and they were very aggrieved by that. It really reduced their GNP. And they fought very hard at the World Health Organization to reform the international health regulations in light of SARS to actually protect travel. And so the international health regulations basically have a three-pronged dynamic. They protect public health, obviously that's primary, but it also protects travel and trade. And there's supposed to be a balance between the three of them.
You've noted that the coronavirus has prompted you to revisit these restrictions. What has changed in the last 20 years, or should I say within the last year, that's led you to make that conclusion?
Let me just start by being absolutely brutally honest. We're flying blind. We actually don't know the extent to which travel helps or harms. Usually it harms. So if you go back to the West African Ebola epidemic, many countries placed travel bans in West Africa, which prevented humanitarian and health workers from going into the region. It devastated the economies, and it had no particular impact with COVID-19. It turned out that countries did use these travel restrictions, some of them with pretty good effect. Certainly island nations like New Zealand and Australia did it well, but even in South East Asia, they did it well. Let's ask genuinely, do we have empirical evidence that a travel restriction will actually work? My guess is that it'll only work on the margins. That is, it'll give us a month or so, or maybe just weeks, to get ready.
Yeah, so given the lack of hard evidence on what travel bans actually do, does that suggest that countries could today maybe be over-relying on travel restrictions when it's not clear that they're effective?
Right now, the latest spate of travel restrictions are to do with this SARS-CoV-2 genomic variant. Countries are just, you know, shutting their borders. We've seen that in Europe. The problem is, you know, that could work, but most likely it's already there, and it's almost certainly here in the United States now.
Is there a possibility that people who get vaccinated could be exceptions to travel restrictions? And what are the implications of that?
It's controversial. You know, it's only happened once in the history of humankind when we did this. That's the World Health Organization's yellow fever certificate. So this would be a very, very novel approach. The problem is how do you prove that you've been vaccinated? How long is the durability of your immunity? And the vaccine certificate can't be a guarantee that you can't spread it, because we don't even know if the vaccine prevents transmission. We only know that it prevents acquiring serious disease.
Still lots that we don't know, but until you have hard evidence, are you thinking about traveling, Professor?
You know, when I was a little boy, I read a novel that still sears in my brain. It was called All Quiet on the Western Front.
Sure.
It was set in World War I. The soldiers endured the most horrific events. And then when the war was over and there was a truce called, a stray bullet came and killed the soldier who was the lead character. And, you know, now that vaccines are so close, I don't want to risk traveling. I want to stay home. I want to shelter. I want to model the best behavior. And then I want to get my vaccine and feel a little bit safer. And I want the rest of the public to do the same.
Lawrence Gostin, a professor at Georgetown Law and the director of their O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks very much, Marco. I appreciate it.
It was the second deadliest terrorism attack in American history, the 1988 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. 270 people killed on board, including 190 American citizens, above the town of Lockerbie, Scotland. After more than three decades, the case is still unfolding, but not closed, says U.S. Attorney General William Barr.
Let there be no mistake. No amount of time or distance will stop the United States and our Scottish partners from pursuing justice in this case.
Yesterday, Barr revealed criminal charges against a third alleged conspirator in the case, a former Libyan intelligence operative. Investigators say he built the bomb that brought down Pan Am 103. Filmmaker Ken Dornstein has devoted much of his life tracking down the ones responsible. It is personal for him. His brother David was killed in the explosion when Ken was just a teenager. Ken Dornstein joins us now. Ken, what did Attorney General Barr reveal yesterday about this man named the bomb maker, Abu Ajila Mohammed Massoud?
I watched the Attorney General's remarks, and it was sort of an out-of-body experience, because here was this person who I had been chasing for so many years and who may have been a phantom. And yet here was the Attorney General of the United States at a press conference saying his name and revealing additional information about him. So to that extent, I was really gratified. At the same time, I think we don't know the details of the confession. We don't know what Massoud would say if he was interviewed directly by the Department of Justice. And I think the timeline that the Justice Department put out left me a little surprised, because they talked about the big breakthrough in the case coming in 2016 when they learned that Massoud was alive and in a Libyan prison. And in 2015, I had broadcast that fact on national television.
And briefly remind us, why was Pan Am 103 targeted by Libyan bombers in the first place?
You know, that's a good question. It's often lost in the quick hit news pieces on the story, because it now seems like it's from another era, an era in which there was a strong man who had a kind of cult of personality, Muammar Gaddafi, who ran Libya, and there was President Reagan. And they were locked in a kind of tit for tat for years. It was a climate of, you know, what we now think of as sort of the first war on terror, where state sponsors were really the major players and not non-state actors. And Reagan and Gaddafi had a back and forth. And at a certain point, Reagan struck Gaddafi. It was an assault on his compound in Tripoli. And many believe now that, you know, it was an attempt to assassinate Gaddafi. And Gaddafi, once he came out of his bunker, he started a revenge campaign that culminated, I think, in the bombing of Flight 103.
So you've been on this case like no one else. You've managed to get into Libya on three assignments, produced a three-part documentary, My Brother's Bomber, for Frontline on PBS. For years, you focused on this former Libyan operative, Abu Ajila Mohammed Massoud. Many people, though, doubted he even existed, but you found him. What can you tell us about him?
That's right. I mean, and it really sounds like a great adventure to go off to Libya, but the great adventure began with some work, boring work at your desk, looking at papers, looking at thousands and thousands of papers in an enormous criminal investigation. And in all that, I seized on a detail about this figure who I was surprised to find hadn't figured into much of the public conversation about the bombing, and he hadn't figured into the trial, and yet he was very closely linked to the one person convicted for the bombing, Al Megrahi. And I thought, well, how could this person be in the same place as Megrahi in an operational way in all these instances that's in the evidence, and yet we don't know who he is? And in fact, the FBI, when they finally got a hold of someone who had information about this person, they called that person puzzle piece. So when you know what to look for, you start to see this character almost like a Zelig. You start to see him in all the important places.
I'm speaking with journalist Ken Dornstein, who for years has been following the Lockerbie bombing case, which is back in the news today. As I said earlier, Ken, this is also personal for you. If you would, can you tell us about your brother, David, what he was like, and how was it that he was on that flight in 1988?
My brother was a big character. He's someone that people remembered. He was a talented writer. He could be a pain. He could be in your face about things. He was very much saw himself as an artist. He went abroad to work on his writing, maybe to write a novel. And he had fallen in love, and he was living abroad. And he came home because, as it is right now, it's the holidays. And he wanted to come home and reconnect with the family. And he in fact, came home early to surprise us and got on a cheaper Pan Am flight that wasn't full. And it turned out to be Flight 103.
So Ken, as a filmmaker, and perhaps more importantly, as the brother of a man who perished in this bombing, do you have a sense now of an ending in this case? Is the end in sight at this point?
It's a mixed bag for me. As someone who made a film on this topic, I'm gratified to see something come of that and to see that furthered. As a brother and speaking personally, I feel that it would be a mistake. It would be magical thinking that somehow getting closer to the truth from this bomb maker and getting closer to that confrontation that I imagined was going to bring me any closer to my brother, because it wouldn't. And I know that. And I also know that years ago, when I decided not to take that next risk to go into a Libyan prison, which would have put me in the potential of being held for ransom myself and to leave behind my own wife and kids to do something like that, I chose to end that there. So in a way, it ended for me with that decision, and everything that happens here on, you know, with the material that I gathered and anything that the Justice Department's able to do, I'd say that they're in charge of justice, and that my own private moments around it are what they are. And I'm trying to get back more to focusing on the life of this person who was so important to me and who I love so deeply, and the facts of his death I'm going to leave to the professionals.
In that wider world, America's relationship with terrorism has changed completely in the 3 decades since the Lockerbie bombing. Gaddafi has since been ousted and killed. I'm just wondering, what difference does it make, do you think, to the U.S. or to Libya to prosecute this bombing now?
Why does justice in the case matter now? Why does it matter that we identify this bomb maker in the bombing of Flight 103, that we hear a full account from him? I think over the years, I might have given different answers to that, but I would say, at this moment, the thing that I'm feeling still matters is about truth and lies, and that Muammar Gaddafi was really the original strongman who conducted his presidency for international cameras. It was very much a television show. He lied in a brazen way. There is very strong evidence that he blew up his own plane, named it Flight 103, and blew it up, and then tried to tell the world that essentially we're even. Because you lost a 103 and I lost a 103, and his lies about his lack of responsibility for the bombing of Flight 103 lasted for his entire life. They lasted until the dying words of Al Megrahi, the convicted bomber, and they continued to have currency out there with different people. And I think it's corrosive to have brazen lies continue despite clear facts. And so I think, to the extent I'm still invested in this, I'm invested in the idea of countering lies with facts, and that ultimately the facts defeat the lies. And I think that Massoud, if he speaks, my hope would still be that the facts would matter, and that if his confession is free and fair and full of details, that it would end those lies, and that's still worth fighting for.
Filmmaker Ken Dornstein, his brother David, was killed in 1988 when Pan Am Flight 103 exploded over Lockerbie, Scotland. Ken produced My Brother's Bomber for Frontline, a documentary about his search for the bomb maker of Pan Am Flight 103. Ken, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. All year, we followed young, first-time Latino voters as part of our Every 30 Seconds project. Just about every 30 seconds, a young Latino turns 18 and becomes eligible to vote in the U.S. Michelle Aguilar Ramirez is one of the voices we've heard from. She's a student in Seattle, passionate about environmental issues. Recently, she moved clear across the state to Spokane, not far from Idaho, and it has not been easy. KUOW's Esme Jimenez has her story.
And then we have some pictures right here. So here's a picture of me, my mom, and my dog.
Over the phone, Michelle Aguilar Ramirez shows me her new home. It's a purple-pink house in Spokane, about 4 hours from Seattle, near the Idaho border. It's been a tough year. Over the summer, Michelle and her family got sick with COVID-19. They also struggled with housing. Her mom worked at a clothing warehouse in Seattle and then got laid off. She now works in housekeeping. But rent in Spokane is cheaper. And one bonus is that Michelle finally has her own room in the new house.
So this is my room.
Uh-huh.
So it's pretty small. I haven't had like my own space in such a long time that I wanted to make sure that I was going to be able to like to stretch and work out and do my homework.
Michelle, who's a high school senior, likes her new home. It's peaceful and quiet. Her family knows some people in Spokane too. But she's noticed one thing. When she walks Bruce, her mini golden retriever, things are a bit stressful.
The block that's in front of me, I avoid intentionally. My dog always wants to walk that way, but I don't walk that way because one of the houses on that side have Confederate flags.
Michelle says those neighbors also had a Make America Great Again flag on their truck. They've since taken it down. She also thinks her family might be the only Latino one on that block. That might be true. Latinos make up only 6% of the population in Spokane. Black residents are just 2%. All of this is making her feel out of place and nervous at times. Some of her family is undocumented. She fears a dispute with a neighbor could escalate to a call to immigration officials.
It's sometimes scary because I don't know if they just don't like me because I'm brown or if they just don't like me because I'm new here or they don't trust me or something. But it gives me like a roller coaster of emotions.
Which makes her guarded. Now Michelle is conscious of what language she uses when she's out grocery shopping.
I feel ashamed for saying this, but like sometimes I don't really like speaking Spanish like out here because I know people stare. So I usually tell my mom like either we need to talk in English or we need to wait till we're outside.
Michelle has noticed that she gets worse treatment than white customers. She's not alone. About 40% of Latinos feel like they've been discriminated against, according to a 2019 Pew Research study. President-elect Joe Biden says he'll work to heal the post-election divides. But when it comes to healing communities, really making neighbors and families trust each other across race and political differences, that will take good faith effort and work. Many people are willing to do that, but not everyone.
Police say he left the backpack inside, and shortly thereafter, smoke from a small fire came billowing out.
This month, Spokane Public Radio reported on a man attempting to destroy the city's Democratic Party headquarters. He walked in with a backpack and told staff he had a bomb. It was a false alarm, but a reminder of the extreme political rifts. For Michelle, that incident and her experiences so far have her rethinking things.
Now that I'm living here, been 2 months, I already got like my fair share of my experience. So I already know that I'm not going to like anything.
Before, she had considered two universities near Spokane. Now, she's considering moving back to Seattle to study, where she says she doesn't have to worry about what language she speaks, where maybe she can fit in again. For The World, I'm Esme Jimenez in Seattle.
Esme Jimenez joins me now. Hi, Esme.
Hey, Margo.
We just heard about some big changes for Michelle Aguilar Ramirez. Over the past year, you've been in regular touch with her. I'm just curious to know how Michelle kind of evolved when it comes to her political identity. What stuck with you from your very first conversations with her?
honestly, that she was incredibly smart and she already knew a lot about politics. Even when she didn't know about something, she would immediately admit that. I think, you know, even as an adult, I find myself sometimes having a hard time with that or other adults. And she would look things up, you know, she would say like, well, I read this article, but then I asked my teacher or I asked my mom or my uncle. So she was just very inquisitive, very hungry to understand more. You know, what was her place in politics?
So if you step back a bit, what did Michelle's story reveal to you about how this kind of loosely defined thing we've come to call the Latino vote, how it's been seen this year nationally, especially when it comes to young Latino voters? Any big surprises for you?
Not giant surprises, but it is just that we need to cover, you know, Latinos with a lot more depth. I think a project like this, especially in comparison to how other national outlets look at covering the Latino vote, you know, it's very easy to have one or two articles throughout a year and say, this is what's happening with this population or this community. But it's completely different to follow someone intimately for months and kind of see them evolve, see them react to local and national news. Seeing them how they're really being impacted by COVID-19 in real time during a pandemic. You know, if they're losing their jobs, if they're struggling with school or being lonely, like all of those things matter. You know, it's not just about the big events that we see in politics. It's about all the little daily lived experiences.
Right. And we heard all of that in Michelle's story. Even though we might not think of Washington State as having a big Latino community like Florida or Texas, what is there to say about the growth of the Latino electorate up in the Pacific Northwest? Like, what stands out to you about the numbers in Washington State?
Well, one, that it's growing, right? In Washington, there's about 1 million Latinos. They're about 12-13% of the state population. By and large, Mexican, Mexican-American. But there's also pockets of Puerto Ricans, Cubans, people from El Salvador and the Dominican Republic. So, you know, you might be thinking Latinos mostly live in California and Texas, but Washington actually ranks among the top 15 states with the greatest Hispanic populations. So especially if you look in, I think, Congressional District 10, that's in central Washington, you know, there we have 40, 50, 60% Latinos in terms of the voter population there. So that's huge. You know, if you're able to actually engage Latino voters, they'll show up for you. They'll do a lot. So actually going back to 2016, you know, Bernie Sanders was one of the few candidates to actually come to central Washington. And then you saw the number of people that were also running at the local office. So there was a lot of Latinas here in Seattle, too. You know, we have Teresa Mosqueda, Lorena Gonzalez, and they're all at the city council level. So I think what we could be seeing is in 5 years from now, 10 years from now, these people might move on and actually do the same at the state level or federal level.
So more Latino representation in some parts of Washington, but there are big contrasts within the state. And we saw how Michelle moved from Seattle to Spokane, where many more voters back Trump. Were you surprised that Michelle is experiencing some culture shock and considering moving back to Seattle?
Frankly, not that much. I'm from Eastern Washington as well, and I know it's a very different cultural and political vibe, if you will. So to hear Michelle talking about Spokane for the first time, I found myself nodding a lot and saying, yes, that's common. Yes, that makes sense. And again, being somebody who's not from a place like Seattle, who grew up with that kind of diversity or liberalness, I think it is a big contrast to suddenly find yourself in Trump land and not really be sure what to do with it.
We have learned a lot from your reporting, Esme. Thank you so much for your work on the Every 30 Seconds project and for sharing Michelle's story with us. We will definitely stay in touch.
Thank you.
That's reporter Esme Jimenez at KUOW in Seattle, a contributor to our Every 30 Seconds series. The world brings you stories that connect you to people and places around the globe. Take a moment to share the stories that stick with you and tag us when you do. We're on Twitter, @TheWorld. The holidays just don't feel the same without gathering around the dinner table, but certain foods can still bring comfort and healing.
The nutritional content of our care packs mean the world of difference when it comes to healing our body, using this food as medicine.
That story is coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. In East Africa, there's a potential humanitarian disaster unfolding. The conflict in northern Ethiopia's Tigray region started more than a month ago. In that time, more than 50,000 people have fled the fighting and crossed the border into Sudan. Now, tensions are spiking at the border. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi reports.
The Handia Transit Center for Refugees sits next to the Tekeze River. On one side is Sudan, on the other is Ethiopia. and the border with Eritrea is not far from here either. Thousands of refugees have arrived here in recent weeks, fleeing the conflict in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region. Berhane is one of them. He's a school teacher, and he asked to be identified by his first name only because he fears for his family's safety back home.
We are lucky because now it's a very peaceful area.
We're sitting in a small tent for pregnant women and new mothers in this transit center. Beside Berhane is his wife Mebrehit and their newborn twins. The baby girls are sleeping quietly, wrapped in colorful blankets. The twins were born in the Ethiopian town of Humera, where Berhane and Mebrehit had gone seeking medical treatment.
We were in the hospital just before the starting the bombing. They were 5 days age.
The 5-day-old twins were in an incubator because they were born prematurely. That's when the fighting started.
Fire, shooting, heavy guns from the Eritrean side. Every people was fleeing. And most of the doctors and professional health professionals were fleeing with the people.
The shooting was coming from the Eritrean side, Berhane tells me. The Ethiopian government has denied receiving support from Eritrea during the conflict, but several refugees told me otherwise. After 3 days of bombing, Berhane says he and Mebrehit fled on foot into the forest, each of them holding one of the baby girls.
We have stayed in the forest, in the farmland for about 4 days, and there we didn't have any food to give them.
While they were hiding from the shooting, he says they passed by victims of the fighting, broken bodies, butchered limbs. They remember one boy in particular, named Zerai, probably around 16 years old.
He died by the heavy guns. And we buried him while we were running towards the Hamdite. He was buried in the Mikael Church in Humera.
Berhane says they buried him near St. Mikael Church in Humera. Due to the limited access to the region, it's difficult to confirm details like this. But Ethiopia's Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, has said military operations in Tigray have resulted in no civilian casualties. Refugees say otherwise. These parents tell me they're surprised they even survived with their newborn children. But their future is still uncertain. Mebrehit says she hasn't been able to breastfeed the babies, and they both weigh less than 3 pounds. They keep telling me to eat, she says, because if I eat good food, I will produce the milk. But there isn't enough food for people here. Things are hard here in Sudan, the couple says, but it's better than being in Ethiopia right now. Abiy Ahmed's government has been saying it's safe for refugees to return to Tigray. Berhane thinks otherwise.
I don't believe this government. It's very liars. He lies.
The couple is hoping to move on to a larger refugee camp called Umrakuba. More than 20,000 refugees have settled there already. It's further into Sudan, the opposite direction from home. In recent days, refugees say Sudanese officials have been pushing people to move there. I spoke with Yagut Mohammed with the Sudanese Red Crescent. He said one reason is insecurity at the border.
We have more soldiers in the border. This area is not safe for refugees.
The area is not safe for refugees, Mohammed tells me over the phone. The UN Refugee Agency recommends that refugee camps be at least one full day of travel from the border. Last week, Sudan's government said Ethiopian forces and militias had crossed into a disputed border area, killing Sudanese soldiers. Sudan has since deployed more soldiers to the border, according to state media. There have also been reports of Ethiopian forces from inside Ethiopia preventing refugees from crossing into Sudan, or even worse, attacking them. Tetemke Asmalash says he has experienced this firsthand. He's been staying in the Hamdayat area, near the river. When I meet him, he's lying on a cot. One of his eyes is bloodshot, and an IV line runs into his hand. There's gauze tied around his leg. It's a gunshot wound, he tells me. I'm a father of three, he says. I brought my children here to the transit center and then went back to harvest my sorghum. A few days ago, he says, he crossed the river to go back to Ethiopia to return to his own land. He wanted the sorghum to make something to eat for his children. Asmalash says militiamen from the Amhara ethnic group shot at him while he was running away. Those militias are thought to be fighting alongside government forces in Tigray. Asmalash tells me that people later helped him get back across the river to Sudan. At one point, he struggles to speak through his busted lip. His friend Debese Tareke fills in the details. He explains that food is in short supply here. Children are going hungry. But crossing back to Ethiopia has proved a dangerous option. Our people in Tigray are being killed, Tareke says. You need to understand that our people are in danger. We need the world to know this and help us go back home safely. Ethiopian officials recently visited eastern Sudan to talk about the return of refugees. The UNHCR says any repatriation of refugees must be done voluntarily. But with the border area proving to be so unsafe, few might be willing to return. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi, Hamdayat, Sudan.
Qatar, a tiny nation, also the wealthiest in the world on a per capita basis, so that buys it some clout. For example, when it comes to international politics and diplomacy, Qatar typically punches above its weight. So when Saudi Arabia and other Gulf Cooperation Council nations imposed a blockade on Qatar 3 years ago, the world took notice. The White House is now trying to ease the blockade in the final days of Trump's tenure. Here to make sense of this is William Lawrence. He's a lecturer at American University School of International Service. He's also a former senior diplomat at the State Department. William, is the Trump administration now attempting to ease the blockade after years of leaving the situation as it is?
Yes. And the main thing that it looks like might be in the works is a opening of Saudi airspace to Qatari planes. And this is very significant because Qatar pays something like $100 million a year to Iran in overflight rights. So this is part of the Pompeo-led State Department and the Jared Kushner-advised White House effort to further put the squeeze on Iran in the final days of the Trump administration. It's also tied to the normalization efforts on behalf of Israel. There's an intense pressure campaign right now on Saudi Arabia to normalize and on Qatar to normalize. And part of that would be mixing it with a new deal.
So just before we go on, we know Iran and Saudi are perennially at loggerheads. Briefly, how does Qatar fit into that relationship?
So Qatar shares a massive gas oil field with Iran, and it managed to have, like all Gulf countries, UAE included, sort of a working relationship with Iran. A lot of Iranian businessmen come in, Iranian professors at the universities, but they managed to, at the same time, have a geopolitical opposition to Iran. What the blockade of Qatar in 2017 did is it pushed Qatar into Iran and made the very reason for the blockade, which was Qatar's closer relationship with Iran, it deepened that problem.
So what are the major sticking points in the negotiations between Qatar and the Gulf Coast countries?
I think it's the end of the Trump administration. Just like the normalization deals with Sudan, UAE, and Morocco, and Bahrain, the first three of which could run into problems in the Biden administration because they don't really have to carry out on the promises being made by the Trump administration. The same thing goes for any Qatar-Saudi deal. And so I've been saying for some weeks now that I think Qatar and Saudi Arabia are going to take more and more and more of a wait-and-see attitude to see if they can't get better concessions, better deals, and follow through on promises from the Biden administration since the exiting Trump administration can't keep its promises.
Yeah, what is the kind of wider geopolitical advantage in the region for the U.S. and Gulf Coast countries bringing Qatar into the fold?
Well, Qatar is the site of a major U.S. military base that for geostrategic reasons kind of has to be in Qatar. That base will stay, and Qatar has been instrumental in U.S. dealings with the Taliban, dealings with Hamas, and dealings with other organizations where the U.S. actually asks Qatar to sponsor these talks. And Qatar has just been generally on the right side of a number of issues that the U.S. has wanted to be, including the Arab Spring. There's a big sort of new Cold War in the Middle East between the pro-Arab Spring and anti-Arab Spring countries. And Qatar has been on the democracy side of the equation, notwithstanding the fact that it doesn't have internal democracy, but it's been on the side of Arab youth and democracy movements in Tunisia and everywhere else.
So you mentioned Jared Kushner being part of the Mideast diplomacy, and he's in Morocco today. Why has he taken a special interest in the situation? And is there anything in it for him?
For me, it's sort of a metaphor of the way Jared Kushner has operated in the Middle East for all 4 years, which is basically on Israel's behalf. And there's no exception now that his own legacy, his father-in-law's legacy, his future investments, his sense that he accomplished something has been all about improving Israel's relationship with its Arab neighbors. The whole reason they were boycotting Israel diplomatically was because of lack of progress on the Palestinian issue. And there's been no progress on the Palestinian issue at all.
William Lawrence is a lecturer at American University School of International Service. William, thanks for coming on the program today.
My pleasure.
The expression Arab Spring, referring to the protests that erupted 10 years ago, was never quite right. First of all, several uprisings started in the winter. But aside from that, for much of North Africa and the Arab world, the popular protests did not make life better. There was no rebirth, no spring, if you will. One country that might be an exception is where the uprisings began, Tunisia. Reporter Lilia Blaise has been speaking with Tunisians, asking them, are they better off now?
There is a lively political debate here about Tunisian democracy. But the real issue for many people is the economy. Inflation and rising food prices are a big worry. There is also a gas shortage. Protesters have blocked a production site in the south of the country. What they want is employment. In the city of Gafsa, I meet 35-year-old Samia. She's waiting in a long line of people hoping to buy a bottle of cooking gas. She's reluctant to tell her full name to a reporter.
I have two kids going to school and I need to make them breakfast in the morning. We haven't had gas for a month, so we've been cooking outside with charcoal. We don't know what to do other than pray.
Samia, but the protesters blocking the gas facility, she says she supports them.
Yes, they have the right. They have the right to do this because of the economic crisis. There are many people affected, not just us. They have been waiting for too long.
Unemployment in Tunisia is 16%. For the youth, it's 36%. Many young Tunisians with college degrees don't have jobs. In the seaside city of Gabès, I meet some protesters. They are blocking the road into an industrial zone. Youssef Hajej says what made today's protests possible were the events of 10 years ago.
Before the revolution, we had a dictatorship. There was no freedom. Now, regular people can protest peacefully and have their voice heard. This was an achievement for the Tunisian people.
After we talked, Youssef got in touch and tells me the protesters are suspending their sit-in because they are now negotiating with the government. But other peaceful protests around the country continue. Hamadi Tizawi is an economics professor at the University of Human and Social Sciences in Tunis. He says social unrest in Tunisia grows out of inequality.
La distribution des richesses à l'échelle régionale pose un...
The distribution of wealth is a problem because the regions where you have resources like gas and oil are not wealthy or thriving. These areas are focused on one industry, but they need to be more diverse economically.
Tizawi says Tunisia needs to modernize its economy and to help people in marginalized parts of the country. They were the first ones to rise up in 2011. Kasrine in the central west was quick to join the protests 10 years ago. A lot of people died there during the uprising. It's where I meet Jalel Alwi. He's a 43-year-old activist who says that his city did not benefit at all from the revolution. The politicians, he tells me, have been a huge disappointment.
There's too much corruption here. We thought that the government would come in with big public projects and reduce unemployment rates, but this didn't happen. Unemployment has gone up and poverty is worse now.
Beyond the economy, another goal of the revolution was about improving human rights. Amneger Ali, who is 48, is with Amnesty International in Tunisia. She says 10 years after the fall of President Ben Ali, the overall situation is mixed.
I think there is no clear-cut picture. There is no black and white. Freedom of expression, for example, is totally unprecedented if we compare it with what we had under Ben Ali. You know, people are able to express themselves freely today. Media, independent media have flourished. But despite that, there are still threats, even on the level of freedom of expression, because we have still the same laws that are in place.
Tunisia's judicial system is still a work in progress, says Siem Ben Sedrine. She's 70 years old, and she started her career as a journalist and human rights activist back in the 1980s. Ben Sedrine served as the head of the Truth and Dignity Commission, set up after the revolution.
Les cas, on a transféré 200 affaires de violations graves.
We managed to transfer more than 200 cases to special courts. These are serious violations, like murder, death under torture, rape, and other crimes against humanity. This is so the regime will be held accountable for its actions and to prevent impunity.
200 cases is a lot, but it's just a start. Ben Sedrine says the commission received more than 60,000 complaints. Political activist Chaim Abouhlel was only 21 years old when the protests started in December 2010. Now, she says, the thing that gives her hope is that people are still talking about the goals of the revolution and not giving up.
I'm happy with the experience that we've learned. We have included the idea of rights and institutions and accountability, even if it is not articulated in, you know, the way that we hoped. But I think it is there, which means that no matter what happens from this point on, I think there's no way for us to go back to pre-revolution. And I think 10 years after, this is something we need to be proud of and we need to be aware of despite the situation.
Bouhlel says the situation still includes economic challenges, corruption, and political strife. But the lesson that Tunisians learn from the revolution is that no one has to be silent anymore. For the world, I'm Lilia Blaise in Tunis.
The $900 billion pandemic relief package that Congress approved last night has a lot in it. Thousands of pages of legislation. It includes cash for American families, financial help for businesses, and more generous benefits for people who are unemployed to help them weather the economic downturn. Also tucked into the package, one of the most significant pieces of climate change legislation that Congress has ever passed, a law allowing the government to dramatically cut the use of hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs. Those are the chemicals in refrigerators and air conditioners, potent greenhouse gases.
Getting rid of HFCs in the United States is a big deal. It's the equivalent of getting rid of 32 million cars each year.
David Doniger is a senior director for climate and clean energy at the Natural Resources Defense Council. He says the new bill from Congress is a big deal.
But it's an even bigger deal if the Kigali Agreement goes forward around the world.
The Kigali Agreement was adopted back in 2016 to phase out HFCs worldwide. Some 120 countries have ratified it. The U.S. and other big emitters are not among them. But Doniger says this new law passed in the stimulus package by Congress paves a way for the Biden administration to enter the agreement.
And if the United States moves ahead with Kigali, I think China and India will join in right away, and this is going to go forward.
The agreement's success could mean avoiding an extra half degree Celsius of warming.
So this is an important move in the United States, but also even more so around the world.
That's because HFCs are far more destructive than your garden variety greenhouse gases. HFCs only represent around 1% of total greenhouse gases, but their impact on global warming can be hundreds to thousands of times greater than carbon dioxide. The new bill passed by Congress would require cutting HFC emissions by 85% by 2035. It also includes $35 billion dedicated to research and development for renewable energy technologies and energy efficiency. President Trump is expected to sign the package of legislation in the coming days. Big meals with families, not supposed to be happening this year, but the smell and taste of a particular food can still offer comfort, even when we're apart. Reporter Valeria Fernandez tells us how one group in Arizona is offering food as a source of healing, especially for indigenous and immigrant families here in the U.S. who've been hit hard by the pandemic.
Did you eat the chocolate already?
No, not yet.
That's when the food tastes good. Yummy, yummy.
It's Catalina's lunch break from online school. She's six and is watching her mother, Sara Nieto, prepare one of her favorite drinks on their patio.
Put in some more milk.
Nieto is making atole. She's using pinole, ground corn, and almond milk and a bit of chocolate. It's a traditional Mexican drink that's served very hot. She grew up in California, but the smell of atole reminds her of her mom. Her parents are from Yucatan and Chihuahua, Mexico.
Something like pinole, for instance, is a part of who we are and has been a part of our ancestral heritage for a really long time, and that now I have an opportunity to share that with my daughter, and hopefully someday she'll share that with her kids too.
In March, Nieto was furloughed from her job as an arts educator. Money's been tight, so moments like this really nourish her.
See, now you know how to make it too.
Nieto got the pinole and a big bag of other indigenous products for free at the Siwapatli Collective. The group, based in Phoenix, started 5 years ago to support women postpartum. But with the pandemic, it was clear they had to do more.
Things like that. We have protein bites made out of blue corn.
Chef Maria Barracano is handing out bags of indigenous dry foods. There's tepary beans and wheat berries, organic blue corn, coffee. She explains these to a young couple just arriving to Paris' offices at the Siwapatli Collective, where she is a co-founder.
Wow, thank you guys. No problem. And there's coffee.
Food like this isn't found everywhere in Phoenix and can be expensive. The collective is giving the food away thanks to a grant from the city of Phoenix with federal funds. The goal is to reach indigenous, immigrant, and communities of color, those hit hardest by COVID-19.
The nutritional content of our care packs mean the world of difference when it comes to healing our body, using this food as medicine, treating it as medicine and thinking, how can this help me?
Food helped Parra too. During her first pregnancy, she got diabetes, and the fourth one, preeclampsia. She said eating food with indigenous ingredients, like the ones her mom used, helped her heal. The women, now part of the Siwapatli Collective, supported her too. One of them is Anjolie Lafery, a psychologist.
Now in the time of COVID, where death and loss and grief are so in our faces, so important to us, right? So maybe food is the entry point and the gateway to like contact with the community, like how it always is, right? For culture and getting to know people. But then you get to know the real stuff, right? What's in the background and what's impacting them. And then here we are able to offer some other services or supports for them.
Online yoga and workshops on women's health are just some of those services. They're also supporting the small businesses. Ramona Botten, who runs a family farm in Arizona, has contributed beans and wheat berries to the food packages. And by doing that, she said, she's passing on indigenous traditions.
With this pandemic, we become spiritual again because of the losses that we can't be with our relatives, our loved ones, and especially our elders now. They're going. Who is going to tell us these things? It was never written in the books.
The collective has reached 1,500 families with food packages. On a recent Friday, a group of volunteers gave away the bags of food at an affordable housing community.
Hi, girls.
Hi.
Thank you for bringing the flyer.
Miguel Rodriguez, originally from Mexico, lives in the housing complex and works recycling metal. He's lost work this year. He struggled to support his family of seven.
Y pues igual una tristeza porque no se puede uno reunir entre familia para que pueda uno convivir.
It's sad, he said, that the pandemic will keep him from seeing family and sharing meals. Yet the food in the bags takes him back to his childhood, to his grandparents' farm and freshly harvested corn. For The World, I'm Valeria Fernandez in Phoenix, Arizona.
Valeria reported the story with support from the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back here tomorrow with you again.
from PRX.